The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
We're roughly following the human life cycle as an order here, but we're going to jump around a little bit. Today we're going to talk about birth control and genetic engineering, which have a lot to do with the beginning of life, of course. And then next time, a subject that I've done a fair amount of work on, in vitro fertilization. And you'll notice that next time your reading is outside of this main textbook here, because they don't deal with in vitro fertilization much. And then the following time, we are going to deal with abortion in current debates. And I'd like you to really get hold of the argument that Bauma et al. Are using, and we will react to that, and as well as what John Frame presents in his appendix. And then on that occasion, the Lord willing, I'm going to show you a very interesting video, which is one of Bill Buckley's firing lines, where he interviewed the Harvard Law professor Lawrence Tribe, who's written a book in which he proposes a way to reconcile pro-choice and pro-life. And we will, of course, react to that. So that's all of that is to do with really the beginning of life. And then we will jump way over into the end of life. However, today, just to confuse things, in the second hour, I want to show you a video from Chestnut Hill Hospital, where I work on the ethics committee, which has to do with the giving of organs. And this really should have to do with the middle or end of life. But I have the tape with me, and I have to get rid of it, so it's going to change our it's going to be anachronistic. But anyway, you'll see why it fits. So let's begin by talking about the whole area of birth control, and I'd like to examine the arguments that are used by Bauma et al. In their chapter 7. Having children and caring for them, becoming and being parents. This chapter is not simply about birth control, of course. It contains moral positions which indeed apply to questions like in vitro fertilization, artificial insemination, and so on. And I'd like to examine not only what they say, but how they set the argument up. And so we want to notice the structure of their argument. They begin, of course, with this remarkable verse of Scripture, the first reflection of the author after the fall about procreation, when the author had said relatively a lot about it before the fall. And it's the verse in Genesis 4:1. Now Adam knew his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain, saying, I've gotten a man with the help of the Lord. And as you know, they take this, and they go from that to new versions of procreation. And they kind of have this little quote here about Louise Brown, who, as you know, is the first successful child born of in vitro fertilization. Now, Gilbert Brown took his specimen bottle and filled it with sperm, and the sperm was placed in a little glass dish along with an ovum, which had been surgically removed from his wife, Leslie Brown, and behold, After the egg was fertilized, it was implanted into the wall of Leslie's uterus and grew. And she bore Louise Brown, saying, "I have gotten a little girl with the help of Dr. Steptoe Edwards and, oh yes, God, a really tubular, non-tubular little girl for sure." Now, this is meant to be, of course, a great contrast to the biblical passage. And they point out, in a way it is a tremendous contrast. In another way, this is not the first new version of procreation. And they estimate nor the last. And the reason they say that is because there are many varieties of new versions of procreation. Some of them, of course, are highly technologically assisted. Others are simply variants on the standard biological procedure. They quote the idea in Exodus of the midwives, and then they talk about the fact that begetting becomes more and more under human control, until today it's possible to intervene at a number of different points of the reproductive process in a number of different ways. The fundamental way in which they argue is by setting up the two most common modern standards of ethical decision making. And then they take those and they compare them to the use of those two in a Christian way. And then, of course, they move on to the whole area of covenant, parenting, and stewardship of children, and so on. And I think I would like us to comment on this. What are the two great themes that they use from modern ethics? Okay, the word they use is that. I think you're right about that. But the word they use, yeah, freedom and utility. And indeed, they had a pretty nice little summary of how that those two were, since Kant, the major themes of ethics. And you probably know from other courses at the seminary here that we tend to look at Kant as a watershed figure who tried to set up a system, an epistemological system and an ethical system, whereby you could believe in absolutes without having to submit to revelation. And of course, much of the history of philosophy since him has been in reaction to that, either affirming it or affirming certain parts of it or disagreeing with it. But in any case, the principle of freedom, which for Kant is autonomy indeed, and utility are both in a kind of unhealthy dialectic in much of modern ethics. I say unhealthy because at times they seem to be in conflict. At times when they're together, they seem to be very powerfully anti-Christian approaches to ethics. But the important point to remember is that most modern people who are not strongly dependent on a Christian worldview will evoke freedom and utility when talking about medical ethics and when talking about procreation in particular. And much of the debate that is going on, not only about birth control, but about in vitro fertilization and artificial insemination and so forth, is in terms of freedom and utility. Now, they take these two very strong themes in modern ethics, and they try to treat them in a Christian way. How well do they do that? Is that a good way to proceed when dealing with the matter of birth control and various forms of artificial insemination and so on? What is your evaluation of their argument?
But in looking at the Bible's perspective, I mean, the Bible acknowledges human freedom, but really that's saying about it. I mean, it's there, but there's no correct comment on it. And also, it doesn't want to be studied a whole lot. I mean, certainly it's there, but it doesn't seem like the Bible is written very, at least in the utility sense.
Okay, that's good. Let's take one at a time. Let's take the freedom one. The Bible doesn't say a lot about freedom. I guess in the sense that you can't find many, many verses which elaborate a doctrine. Yeah. However, there is, I think there's implicitly a fair amount about it. In what way are the biblical notions of freedom quite different from the Kantian idea, or the, you know, just the modern idea? Whether you've been able to read this stuff or not, you probably could establish that. And how well do they set up the contrast? What's the difference that they point out between freedom in the modern sense and freedom in the theological or biblical sense? Well, let me read it for you, because it's quite well put, I think. On 183, children, they say freedom itself is better understood in the Augustinian fashion, not as the unconstrained choice of a neutral agent to will what he will, but as the capacity of an agent precisely to establish a self, to set that self upon some good, to determine an identity in one's choices, and then to will and to act in ways consistent with the established self. Now, all that language comes down to meaning that in the Kantian sense, freedom amounts to being a neutral agent, that you are here at a crossroads between choice A and choice B, and that there is no intrinsic reason why you should choose one or the other. You have to come up with one, and it might be utility, it might be you like it better, it might be a great moral thing, but the point is that you, in the modern idea, you're not already inclined towards one, and that's very different from the biblical sense. And the other point is that freedom is not so much a positive, but a negative value. In other words, it's not so much freedom within a structure to do the good, though, you know, that's not totally excluded, but it's negative. That is, I am not bound. I am not a slave of circumstance. I can overcome something, and I can take this on. Now, that all of that has half truth to it, but it's very important to see the difference, because let's take what are the theological implications if freedom is what the modern view is. You know, let's say that Adam is your ideal type. If freedom were the modern sense of the neutral agent facing options, how would we evaluate Adam's choice? Okay, why? True. Okay. Well, but even beyond the consequences, what would it be? How do we view God setting things up that way? Yeah, he becomes the author of evil because he's placed the person in a position where a wrong choice is a real possibility. Now, in one sense that's true, in another sense it's not true. God didn't say, Adam, here's this option, and look, I'd prefer you did this one, but you know, it's up to you. He didn't say that. He said, look, this is a very specific thing. You are already in obedience to me. Now, to prove for my greater purposes your total allegiance, I'm going to give you a test. But there's nothing in the environment nor in your nature that inclines you to fall. If you do fall, you die. I thought that's a very, very different thing. In other words, the idea, the freedom that Adam had was not as a neutral agent to kind of take an option, but it was freedom to establish himself by doing good. As they put it here, the capacity of an agent precisely to establish a self, to set that self upon some good, to determine an identity in one's choices, and then to will and act in a way consistent with the established self. Now, I think they go a little overboard on the self business. I think freedom in the biblical idea is much more the human person's obligation and joy to do the good, but it's not primarily establishing a self. There might have been something of that in Adam's choice, sure, because he would have grown to recognize evil, and eventually he would have come into that consummate bliss, which Reformed theology talks about, that wasn't the same kind of happiness as that he already had. But I think this is a little bit too much emphasizing the self, but the point I think is right, that it's very different from the modern idea. Now, this may raise the question in your mind, it should raise the question in your mind, how can you be free if the only idea of freedom is already determined what you're supposed to do to be free? And that's a hard one, because we're so used in the modern context to think of freedom to do what we want as over against constraint. We have a hard time with the biblical idea that freedom is doing God's will. That's a completely different idea of freedom from the modern idea. Yes, in a fallen world, we do have this other kind of freedom. We can sin. But that's not the essence of freedom. That's not what God wants for us. When we get to heaven, we won't want that kind of freedom, even if we were given it. But we're still free. The angels are free, even though they can only do good. And that's a jarring idea for the modern mind, you know. But it's the biblical idea that the essence of freedom is self-determination according to God's will, not neutral choosing of options, because we're not neutral. Now, why do they contrast these two, and why? How does this relate in their argument to having children and to birth control? Very interesting argument here. Well, think about it. Let's take the easier questions first. Only relatively easy to ask. What biblical evidence could you amass for authorizing birth control? You know, I mean, on the surface, it looks like it's kind of a funny idea. You're told to have children to multiply. You're told that life is sacred and so on. You're going to argue now that you can have a limited number or space them or whatever. How would you use what you know from the Bible to defend such a position, or is it just indefensible?
One thing I think about is the Bible emphasizes responsibility.
Okay.
So, if you look at ourselves, have we reached a place where we can responsibly care for children as God would have care for them, and we should not have more children than we can responsibly care for based upon circumstances and external interests and all kinds of things.
Yeah, okay.
And
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's I never thought of that connection. That's a good connection. How does the idea of freedom impact, as they say, the choices at birth? Because, see, that's the argument that most people use today for birth control. You know, we're free. We can have as many or as little or none. It's our life. And what they do here is they say freedom is important but completely insufficient for determining decisions about procreation. They say that when you're discussing new procreative powers, the burden of proof should not be borne only by those who limit freedom, but also those who ignore or deny what they call the embodied character of human nature and reduce persons to their capacity for rational choice. I thought that was a very good point, that if you have a really biblical doctrine of freedom, then you're not going to fall into this idea that the capacity for rational choice is the be-all and end-all of a human being. Yes, the human being has that capacity. Yes, it has certain contours, and it's prominent in the Bible, but it is not a sufficient principle for determining what you're going to do with artificial birth or birth control devices, because you want to do that according to what God wills. And no matter how free you are, if God doesn't want you to limit things, then you're not going to want to do it. Of course, they have a different view, and so do I. I think it's very wise to bring in the freedom issue at the beginning, because that's where the average reader is going to resist, and so they kind of tackle that issue first. And then they say that as they treat this, you need to bring in other principles. Now, the next other principle they bring in is the second one, utility. Okay, now how do they handle that? Those are the two modern themes, freedom and utility. How do they deal with utility, and what is the what's the essence of the modern utility argument, and how is it different from a Christian argument? Right. Right. The first of all, numbers. In John Stuart Mill's, ethics based on a number of previous ethicists, it's the idea of the greatest good for the greatest number of people. And sounds wonderful until you realize that justice doesn't always follow the majority, and there are individuals who are completely different from the rest, who may be right and the rest may be wrong, and you do it on principle. They also say that utility calculations tend to be centered on what people achieve rather than what people express. Okay? Tends to be based on the result, in other words, rather than on what people really believe, let alone the fact that it doesn't deal with what the Bible says. And then they also point out that utility arguments tend to be in terms of risks and benefits, but that's deceptively simple. Now, in the two arguments that you used just recently, that parents should be able to provide for their children, that can be a very Christian principle. That can also slip into utility if you're not careful, because you can begin to talk about risks and benefits, And who on earth is capable of deciding what a risk or a benefit is? You know, we've had so many young couples come to us and say, well, we've decided not to have children for a while, you know, because we can't afford them, you know, I'm in graduate school and so forth and so on. Believe me, you never can afford children. Not today. And it's always exhausting, it's always costly, and if you go on a strict risk and benefit, you need reasons that are strong enough to overcome the average risk argument. And admittedly, today, the risk arguments are getting more and more flimsy. But I think they rightly say that utility also has its place. But the weighing of harms, risks, hopes, and so forth is not a purely technical matter. And the application of the impartial principle of utility depends on profound convictions about the future and about technology and about parenting. And I would add about what the biblical warrant. So, again, I think that is very wise of them to take these two arguments and to try to deflate them at the beginning, or at least to reinvest them with other meaning, because they are so prevalent. And then they go on to technology, discussions of technology. Again, what's the major caution about technology as they use? Right. It certainly is good in itself. And technology, despite Elul and Neil Postman and people like that, McLuhan, is good in itself. However, they do add a tremendous caution, and it's put rather nicely. Of course, you've heard all this in sermons and things, but they say that be very careful to go as you go from can to may. You know, this is, I think, a real obsession in our modern age. Just because you can do it doesn't mean you should do it. But we can do a lot of things, and we can do more things every day. And does that mean you should? This is a really difficult one, because the 18th century idea of progress would tell us that the road to the good is by simply exploring all possibility, and then when that possibility has become an actuality, well, the question is solved. Just do it, you know. But you then get into, you know, trouble when you see people producing cobalt bombs and so on, and in human reproduction, of course, it's the same problem. Just because you can produce babies in vitro, does it mean you should do it? Now, I'm going to argue next week that there are certain cases where it can be legitimate, but I think they're right to ask the question. And they're also right to raise the very difficult matter of control. If you want to control what kind of baby you have, what are we getting into? They point out, I think it's in this chapter, they point out that, now, I don't know where they got this, I noticed it wasn't documented, maybe Laura, you can correct them, but they said that on average, the first child is a fighter, and the second child is more laid back. And they said, therefore, surveys show that if people could choose what kind of children they'd want a boy first and a girl second. And that's a sexist idea. All right, I don't know if that's true, but...
Well, I mean, there are a lot of expectations placed on the first child, not necessarily.
Okay. Okay.
Ellen Bennett of the Boston Globe admits that poll of the most radical women in Cambridge showed that the women wanted voice.
That's interesting. It sounds right. I just didn't see any documentation on it, so I just, you know, I just have a doubt on that.
Lots of studies and books and stuff.
Yeah.
That try to determine what kind of personality on birth order.
And that being the case, then they go on to show that people of all stripes will want this type of baby first and this type of baby first. And that's, of course, indeed very, very dangerous. It's dangerous at all, I think, to select what kind of sex your child's going to be, because there's a nice balance right now. The women have it by a percent and a half. But there's this mysterious way in which the Lord provides the earth with about the equal number of each. And you start tampering with that, you better really know what you're doing, especially if the reason you're doing it is because of preference, you know. Now, they're not excluding all that, and when we get to genetic manipulation, we'll show some cases where you might be able to use manipulation for certain good places, but they're putting a very, very strong warning down. Careful not to use technology as society's toolbox to get what it wants is, I think that's how they put it. So moral caution, though not moral prohibition on these things. Yeah,
if I can ask a question.
Please.
Without using genetic technology, I mean, this is an issue. I'm not married, I haven't had to face it, but it seems like if you already have, let's say, a girl child, and for a number of reasons, it looks like one more child would be the best thing to do. And there is a thing as far as timing, I mean, when the egg is released in the woman, you can enhance the probability that it will be a girl or a boy depending upon the time of union. Are you saying it's best not to mess with that at all? Just leave it, so to speak, in the hands of the Lord?
Yeah, I guess I am saying that. I would not go so far as to say that that's never, ever appropriate, but I'm so concerned about what we would do to our world if we began to make such choices for the sake of a little nuclear family. You know, and I have a good friend in France who has five daughters, and they're Catholics, you know, and they say, Catholics are supposed to have boys, you know. We've had these wonderful girls, and... It's been hard, you know. We've had to marry them all off, you know, Catholic. So, to change that, to control that, would be to introduce such a radical change in the way in which you approach having children that I think it's very dangerous. And you'd go from there to start preferring blondes as opposed to brunettes, and then you'd start preferring people who are smart to people who are average. And is that what we want in our society? Do we want a lot of smart people? Boy.
You know what happens to those parents if they don't get what they want? What happens to the way that child is raised?
Mm. That's a good point.
If they wanted a boy and they got a girl,
yeah.
They try and force that girl to be a tomboy.
Yeah. And we've seen that happen a lot. I mean, with cases that we know, parents, you know, who desperately wanted a boy and they get a girl and they name the girl a boyish thing, they go on then to argue exactly the way you are, that parenting is not only a matter of developing the children's freedom, but of developing the parents' freedom. And in their definition, that means conforming their ego to God's will. And so the idea of the gift of children from God is a gift that is for the sake of the children, but also for the sake of the giver and the agents of the gift, the parents. This is, I think, a good argument for the fact that as you make your decision as parents, you want to be careful that you are being utterly fair to the child, and the only way to be utterly fair to the child is to be clear yourself morally, to be ethically clear, and to be on the grounds of wanting God's will. Now, that does not directly answer birth control or in vitro fertilization, of course, and that's not the intention of this chapter, but those are the kind of foundational principles whereby they set this up. When we get to the specific discussion of in vitro fertilization, we will want to consider what circumstances lead a couple to go to that extreme. And of course, the major circumstance is infertility. And I'll be spending some time talking about what that means biblically. And they did not spend much time on that here. I suppose most of these people are Dutch and they don't have much problem with infertility. I don't know. Dutch have these big families. But they, I think that would have been a very important thing to add here. But their thrust is good, even though I felt they emphasized a bit too much the ego side of freedom. And their thrust is to show that having children, or the spacing of them and the freedom to have fewer of them, is a much larger question than whether or not you'd prefer boys, or whether you'd prefer to have enough money to pay for their tuition, or whether you'd prefer to have two or three. It's a question of conforming to God's will, respecting the gift, both of the child and of the giver, and the social constraints, the social needs, that fuller picture. And so I think it has a lot of wisdom here. They do talk about how the people who have children are not the only people who have children. The people who don't have children can have children by adoption, by ministry, by all kinds of ways. And it does, again, just because you don't have children doesn't mean you have to desperately go after means that give you those, though I think you can make a case occasionally for that to be true. Any questions about their approach? Their conclusion is rather a modest one. They say that they lack the wisdom to settle some of these moral issues, but they say wisdom is what you need, caution and wisdom. Caution born of humility rather than fear. And then they say they're going to show in that means restricted freedom and restraint of progress, but also who the players are and so on.